Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present U.S.-Iraq War veteran Matt Southworth, who assesses the renewed sectarian conflict in Iraq and the calls by some for another round of American military intervention there. Falco Schilling of the Vermont Public Interest Research Group, who discusses the significance of the national food industry's lawsuit challenging the state's recently passed GMO labeling law. And Adam Crowther of Public Citizens Congress Watch, who talks about the powerful influence wealthy individuals like the billionaire Koch brothers now have on local election campaigns. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Argentina, South America's second largest economy, faces an imminent default on its bonds after the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear an appeal on a case brought by billionaire American investor Paul Singer. The hedge fund investor refused to negotiate a deal to reduce Argentina's debt, a decade after the country defaulted on $100 billion in bonds. In winning his case in U.S. courts, Singer, owner of Elliott Management, is owed $1.5 billion by the end of June. More than 90% of Argentina's creditors agreed to slash this debt by 70% in exchange for new bonds, which the nation has been paying off. Singer and other hedge fund investors in the case refused, seeking full payment of bonds plus back interest. U.S. courts have ruled that Singer and other holdout creditors must be paid in full. Argentina's President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner blasted the U.S. Supreme Court ruling, declaring, "Argentina has no reason to be submitted to this kind of extortion." In recent days, however, Argentina has moderated its tone, asserting it is willing to negotiate with holdout creditors, but no talks are scheduled before the bond payment deadline on June 30th. Eric Lecompte of the debt relief group Jubilee USA told The Guardian, "For heavily indebted countries trying to support extremely poor people, this is a devastating blow. These hedge funds are equipped with an instrument that forces struggling economies into submission." The Rio Grande Valley on the Texas-Mexico border has become ground zero in the latest immigration crisis as thousands of children from Central America cross the border in unprecedented numbers. Many are reported to be fleeing crime and gang violence at home and hoping to win sanctuary in the United States. The estimated 200,000 migrants that have crossed the Texas border in recent months has put intense pressure on the Obama administration to address the crisis, as detention centers in both Texas and Arizona have become overwhelmed. Some child migrants have been released to relatives in the U.S., raising hopes they could win permanent status. The crisis prompted Vice President Joe Biden to meet with leaders of Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras to stop the flow of young migrants to the U.S. border. White House domestic policy advisor Cecilia Munoz insisted, "This is a very dangerous trip that people are taking. People are putting their children in the hands of smugglers in the hope or misconception that they will be allowed to stay." Several immigrant rights groups, including the ACLU, have sued the Department of Homeland Security, claiming children in custody faced physical and sexual abuse. The flex-time workforce has grown nearly 50% since the 2008 financial crisis. The Christian Science Monitor reports that many workers have found themselves faced with the choice of accepting non-traditional schedules or losing their jobs. A survey of companies by Ardent Partners, a market research firm, found that 30% of all workers are now non-full-time employees, nearly triple the number since the recession hit. Traditionally, temporary and other contingent workers have been the first fired and first rehired in times of economic distress. The recent downturn in one way was no exception. Many companies slashed their workforce of temporary employees early in the recession. Their numbers declined by more than 30% from the beginning of the downturn to its lowest point. But almost 5 years after the official end of the recession, many companies haven't sought to rehire workers and return to pre-recession employment levels. Instead, some have found that having a large non-traditional workforce has made them more profitable. Critics accuse many companies of classifying people who are clearly employees as independent contractors so they can block them from joining unions, negotiating pay increases, and being eligible for unemployment compensation and other benefits. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
As President Obama announced the deployment of 300 U.S. military advisors to assist Iraqi security forces, Sunni insurgents of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, continue to advance their drive to capture key cities and other strategic sites across Iraq. As he spoke publicly about sending the first U.S. soldiers back to Iraq since the withdrawal of combat forces there in December 2011, Mr. Obama's earlier statement that we will not be sending troops back into combat in Iraq appeared to be open to interpretation. The president has said that he is prepared to take targeted and precise military action, including a campaign of airstrikes that administration officials say could be extended into neighboring Syria. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who was sent to Baghdad by Mr. Obama on an urgent diplomatic mission, told reporters that Iraq's very future will be determined in the coming days as he urged the nation's feuding leaders to form a unity government of Sunnis, Shia, and Kurds and confront the ISIS insurgents who have repeatedly forced the Iraqi military into retreat. While the White House was formulating its response to the Iraq crisis, former Bush administration Vice President Dick Cheney leveled harsh criticism at Mr. Obama, declaring that his decision not to leave a residual force in Iraq had produced the current sectarian conflict. But Cheney and the other neoconservative architects of the 2003 invasion of Iraq, who have regularly been featured on news programs to discuss the crisis, were condemned by many as unqualified to offer advice, given their stunning failures in Iraq. Your reporter spoke with Matt Southworth, an Iraq War veteran, who in 2004 was stationed near the strategic town of Tel Afar, recently captured by Sunni militants. Southworth, who currently works with the Friends Committee on National Legislation and is a member of the group Veterans for Peace, discusses his views of the current Iraq crisis and the Obama administration and congressional response.
You know, looking at the situation in Iraq now, it's really gripping. You think about the sacrifice not only of U.S. service members, which was great, you know, several thousand killed in action, tens of thousands wounded. I mean, I always say to friends, I was in Iraq for a short period of time, and my experience left me with a great amount of trauma. But Iraqis are living that every single day. Fast forward 10 years, I've been out of the war since 2004, but the war has continued for most Iraqis. So it's absolutely tragic. Of course, there have been periods that were punctuated with relative stability, but for the most part, it's been pretty chaotic in Iraq. And I look back and think about all the Iraqi friends I made, and I think about the way the country was in 2004 and how much precipitously worse it is today. And it's hard to just imagine the loss and the suffering. Tens of thousands killed in action, maybe 100,000 civilians, we really don't know. Millions internally displaced and refugees. The situation is beyond dire, and it's incredibly sad to witness.
From your perspective, having served in Iraq during the war, what are your views as to the underlying causes of the disintegration of the Iraqi state that we're now seeing?
Well, you know, I've watched a lot of pundits and a lot of real smart people talk about this over the last few weeks. And the truth is, I really don't know. I'm certainly no expert on Iraq or Iraqi politics or Iraqi culture. My sort of layman perception is that the majority of Iraqis do not view their government, the Maliki government, as a legitimate government. And yes, there are extremist groups involved in this uprising. ISIS is the most well-known one at the moment. But the truth is, this is an uprising of many different Iraqis across many different stripes and creeds. And they are pushing back, as you know, what they view as an illegitimate government with considerable U.S. support, which is part of the reason why I am advocating against military intervention, as are many other veterans and, you know, other folks.
Matt, What is your response to President Obama's decision recently announced to send 300 or more U.S. military advisors to Iraq to assist in the fight against the ISIS-Sunni militants' successful capture of many Iraq's key and major cities and border crossings?
Yeah, I'm incredibly disappointed in that decision by President Obama. I think we had an opportunity to change the nature of our involvement with Iraq by saying, look, you know, there are different ways we can address this. The first thing we're going to do is end unconditional aid to Iraq and the Iraqi government. We're not going to intervene militarily, and we're going to call for a comprehensive settlement of all parties. We're going to work to get everyone in the right room and talking. And instead, the president said there's no military solution to Iraq, so therefore I'm going to send some military advisors. It just really doesn't make a lot of sense. And I think in a lot of ways it was a missed opportunity. It wasn't as bad as it could be, I suppose. You know, the president could have announced a reinvasion of Iraq. Seems unlikely given the political climate in the U.S. that that would have happened. But, you know, there's been a tremendous amount of sacrifice over the years by veterans and others. So I think there might be some kind of, you know, feeling that there needs to be action to take care of, you know, that loss, that feeling of this would all be for nothing. But from my perspective, I think this was a really bad move, and it will only further the violence and worsen the humanitarian crisis, and really serves, you know, in no way will it bring peace or stability to the very fragile state of Iraq.
As this crisis really comes into focus here, is it your view that preserving a united Iraq important for the Iraqi people? Or is the proposal of partition or the predicted outcome of partition of the country a better option, carving Iraq into Kurdish, right, Sunni, and Shia sectors?
Well, you know, I have to say that this question and the question, I hear it repeated often in a lot of different ways, a lot of different forms, is sort of at the heart of the problem. The idea that we get to decide or we should have an opinion, I think ultimately it is for the Iraqis to decide. Ultimately, I think the best role for the international community in this is to encourage as nonviolent a transition as possible to whatever Iraq decides to do next and Iraqis decide to do next. What's clear to me is that the government has been dissatisfactory at best and just egregiously manipulative and wrong at most. And if Iraq wants a new constitution, if the Iraqis do, and want a new sort of government to represent them, or if they want a partition, you know, that's up to the Iraqis. And the best we can do, I think, is provide aid and relief for the humanitarian crisis, develop an arms embargo against Syria and Iraq, you know, reject another military intervention and halt the unconditional military aid, and try to gather a conference of the key stakeholders at one table to decide how to move forward with this really dire situation. But what I know beyond any shadow of a doubt is that adding military force to this already militarized problem will not bring peace and stability to Iraq. Peace is possible through peaceful means, not through military force. And I think that's a lesson we should have learned by now.
That was Matt Southworth, an Iraq War veteran who currently works with the Friends Committee on National Legislation. Find more news and analysis on the current Iraq conflict by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In May, Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin signed the nation's first standalone law requiring foods made with GMOs, genetically modified organisms, sold in retail outlets to be labeled beginning in July 2016. The law applies to all foods that are genetically engineered, which are almost exclusively processed foods at this point. Vermont's Right to Know GMOs Coalition campaigned for the law, arguing that labeling would provide consumers transparency about the foods they purchase. Two other New England states, Connecticut and Maine, have passed GMO labeling laws, but both depend on nearby states taking similar action for them to go into effect. Almost two dozen other states have considered GMO labeling laws this year, according to Food and Water Watch, which tracks and supports such bills nationwide. On June 13th, the consortium of big food trade groups, the Grocery Manufacturers Association, the Snack Food Association, the International Dairy Foods Association, and the National Association of Manufacturers, filed a lawsuit against Vermont in federal court to block the law, declaring the legislation unconstitutional on the grounds that states cannot regulate commercial speech. Expecting challenges to the new law, the state legislature had already established a $1.5 million fund to defend the measure against future litigation. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Falco Schilling, consumer protection advocate with the Vermont Public Interest Research Group based in Montpelier. Here he describes how GMO labeling advocates succeeded in convincing lawmakers to pass the bill, what it will mean for consumers, and the outcome he expects from the lawsuit.
The Grocery Manufacturers Association, the Snack Food Association, and a few other organizations decided that this was a law that they wanted to try and stop from going into effect, so they filed suit against the state of Vermont to try and make sure consumers were being kept in the dark about what was in their food.
Several surveys show the vast majority of Americans are in favor of this kind of food labeling, but the industry says there's no difference between GMO and non-GMO food, and labels will confuse consumers. And that's the position of the Food and Drug Administration, too, right?
The FDA has basically taken a hands-off approach when it comes to regulating genetically engineered food. They allow the companies to do their own testing and then verify that these foods are safe, because they see them as the same as any other food and don't see that it should be any different, even though these foods are ones that could not be found in nature, involve genes from other organisms that just couldn't combine in nature. And we have seen that over 90% of Americans want to see genetically engineered foods labeled. The New York Times found that, and it's just been really consistent over the last couple of years that the vast majority of Americans want to see labels on their food, and that's really what we were trying to do with this law, is just give consumers some basic information to allow them to make informed decisions.
Both California and Washington State had multi-million dollar campaigns on food labeling on the GMO issue. And when the effort started, a big majority of voters were in favor of labeling, but both initiatives failed. How did Vermont get this bill passed?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons we were able to pass this. As you were saying, in California and Washington, there was extremely well-funded opposition to some ballot initiatives where they're spending records amounts of money. And also, even in Washington State, the grocery manufacturers were sued for their tactics of trying to hide their corporate contributions because they were funneling millions of dollars from their members without letting the public know who was trying to keep them in the dark. But here in Vermont, what we were able to do is we launched one of the largest grassroots efforts the state's seen in years, and we're able to gather over 30,000 signatures from Vermonters asking their representatives to label these food. And then constituents just stayed in contact with the representatives and their senators, asking them to give them the right to know what they are eating and make informed decisions about what they're buying at the supermarket.
How would this affect, if at all, dairy farmers in your state? Like if farmers use bovine growth hormone, BGH, would that be included in the bill's provisions? And are any farmers in Vermont using that?
I believe a number of farmers do use bovine growth hormone in Vermont. To my knowledge, would not be covered under this legislation. Basically, it says that we're trying to label foods that are themselves genetically engineered. So it doesn't require labels on things like milk when a cow has eaten genetically engineered feed, but it would require a label on a food that is itself genetically engineered. So if we got to the point where we're genetically engineering cows, that milk would be labeled. But as we're seeing salmon, genetically engineered salmon is likely coming on the market soon, and we'd make sure that there's a label on that.
What's next in this fight?
Well, at this point in time, we're going to be looking at the ways that we can make sure that this law stands up and doing everything we can defend this law in court and any other means that are available to us. We're going to be trying to work with the state, coordinating with them and coordinating our efforts and making sure that Vermont gets the C labels on genetically engineered foods.
I'm sure you're expecting a huge influx of money in opposition to the law. Is that happening already?
We're facing some extremely well-funded opposition on this that are going to do everything they can to keep consumers in the dark and basically use their bullying tactics to try and make sure Vermonters don't know what's in their food. But we think we have the law on our side, and we're going to be doing our darndest to make sure that we see labels on foods in 2016.
I know organizations that promote organic food were big supporters of the labeling law. But just to be clear, this is really a different issue than whether foods are organic, right?
So organic foods cannot include genetically modified organisms because that's excluded under the organic standards, but there people can buy non-genetically engineered foods that aren't themselves organic, and that's a whole other part of the market that we're seeing expanding at this point as more and more consumers voice their concerns about these products and voice their preference for foods that aren't genetically engineered.
That was Falco Schilling, consumer protection advocate with the Vermont Public Interest Research Group. Find more news and commentary on the campaign to label GMO foods across the U.S. on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission case in 2010, the floodgates of unlimited and unaccountable money from corporations and unions in U.S. politics were open wide, very wide. But while many progressive activist groups, which opposed the high court decision, traced the exponential increase of money influencing the outcome of federal elections, there was little attention being paid to the effect the Citizens United ruling had on local politics. A new report from Public Citizens Congress Watch, titled Outside Spenders, Local Elections, tracks the impact of large amounts of money targeting local elections given by the conservative political advocacy group Americans for Prosperity, which was founded by the billionaire brothers Charles and David Koch. The report focuses on six local elections in which Americans for Prosperity injected funds and organizers to pursue its agenda of reducing government spending, lowering taxes, weakening labor unions, making the judicial system more friendly to big business, and opposing environmental regulations. The local elections examined in the report included school board elections in Kenosha, Wisconsin and Douglas County, Colorado, a mayor's race in Lakeview, Minnesota, city and county elections in Coralville, Iowa and Iron County, Wisconsin, and a zoo tax referendum in Columbus, Ohio. Your reporter spoke with Adam Crowther, a researcher with Public Citizens Congress Watch and author of the report. Here he outlines how outside money and local political contests have hijacked issues of concern to these communities and what can be done to place limits on how money is raised and spent on elections.
As more and more reports were sort of trickling in about spending by sort of these national groups in local elections, we sort of wanted to take a deeper dive into what's actually going on. And we centered our research around one particular group, which is Americans for Prosperity, which is one of sort of the many groups that are presumably funded by the Koch brothers, Charles and David Koch. And so we started doing news clip searches, sort of saying, where is Americans for Prosperity spending? What elections are they getting involved in? And we found a number of sort of hyper-local races across the country. I think the smallest sort of race we found was a county in sort of northern Wisconsin called Iron County. There's only 6,000 people that live there, and Americans for Prosperity, which in 2012 had $115 million in revenue, was sending out mailers and canvassing on behalf of essentially a mining company that wanted to open an open pit mine there. And so it's just really surprising the degree to which this group is engaging in these elections that, a couple of years ago, you'd have never expected to see a national group. And so it's something that is increasingly surprising. And I think when we think about how local elections should be conducted, it's very surprising.
It seems like from reading the summary of your report, it appears that anti-union activity is really at the heart of some of what the Koch brothers are targeting in these elections.
I think that's right. In one of the races in Douglas County, Colorado, it was a school board race. And Americans for Prosperity spent about $350,000 to preserve the sitting board, which had taken actually a lot of steps to weaken teachers' unions in the county. Another case in Kenosha, Wisconsin in 2014, the sitting school board had actually agreed to negotiate a contract with the teachers' union there, which had presumably been banned by recent legislation in Wisconsin. A third case up in Lakeview, Minnesota, which is a pretty small city up there, a candidate for mayor who had previously served on city council voted to preserve a part-time unionized electrician job while he was on city council, which was the sole justification for Americans for Prosperity engaging in that particular race.
Has there been a backlash effect, such as these large, well-funded political organizations coming into a small town where opponents of what these groups are doing can point out and say, these folks don't even live here. They don't even live in our town, and they're trying to influence these elections. Has there been any kind of reversals they've suffered because of it?
Yeah, I think you're on the right track. I think when you look at the actual results of the elections, it's about a wash. Of the six elections we looked at closely, I think you could reasonably say that, you know, Americans for Prosperity, their preferred candidates or their preferred policy position, they won out about half the time in three of the cases. In the other three, they were sort of a little bit less successful. But what you do see sort of percolating out of the surface of these races is a sentiment among local citizens of, you know, why is this group here? Sort of local elections are sort of the last sort of bastion of pure democracy in a lot of ways. It's friends and family who are running for office. And I think that one of the bigger issues is that issues that are really important to local citizens are being pushed aside a little bit when the terms of the debate are shifted because America's Prosperity can drop $350,000. It really, I think, upsets the sort of the balance of how local elections are run.
Just a last question for you here. What's the remedy for this, in your view? With the Supreme Court ruling, how can citizens reform the campaign finance system to limit the outsized influence of millionaires and billionaires like the Koch brothers and these giant corporations? There is a high degree of difficulty in passing what many groups are working for, which is a constitutional amendment that would override what the Supreme Court let loose there in terms of the Citizens United decision, releasing unregulated and unaccountable money.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think we've actually reached the point where we sort of have to call for a constitutional amendment. The Supreme Court recently, and Citizens United and McCutcheon have sort of redefined what the First Amendment means. They basically said that spending on elections, contributing to elections, influencing politics is a protected form of speech. It's in the Constitution. And so at this point, the only way to really try to roll that back is to change the Constitution, is to, you know, add an amendment to the Constitution that basically says that Congress, you know, state legislatures can pass reasonable limits on how much money can be raised and spent in politics. To basically let Congress have more control over what's going on in our elections right now. You know, a couple of years ago, it would have seemed maybe a little bit crazy that we would need a constitutional amendment to sort of govern our elections. But I think the spending has gotten so out of control that it's actually one of the last options we have left.
That was Adam Crowther, a researcher with Public Citizens Congress Watch and author of the report titled Outside Spenders, Local Elections. Find links to the report and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Evan Beter, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.